Hey there, welcome into another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
I'm Lisa Brawls.
I'm John Steinbach.
It's great to have you back with us for another episode. We're recording this on Wednesday morning, the day of a very big basketball game for the University of Illinois, which will be done by the time this is posted. And I don't think 2 weeks ago we would have thought that this would be a very big game for the University of Illinois.
I'm raising my hand.
Yes. So
I've been following along, as in watching the games and being very present while watching the games. But I'm not really listening to the analysis, the sort of odds making and what it all means. Mm-hmm. So explain to me, please, guys, what it all means.
Well, for the first time in a couple of years, Illinois has won three straight Big Ten games. And as a result of that and a result of some other teams on the so-called NCAA tournament bubble not playing very well, Illinois is at least in the conversation again for an NCAA tournament bid. I think most things that I've read, and feel free to chime in here, John, most things that I've read say that if Illinois wins its last two regular season games against Michigan State Wednesday night and against Rutgers on Saturday, plus wins one more game in the Big Ten tournament, that would probably be enough to get them in the NCAA tournament.
Do other people have to lose in order for that to happen? Is that part of the scenario?
Well, part of that would probably be Illinois playing kind of another bubble-ish team in the Big Ten tournament and beating them, which would give them another loss. But there are other teams kind of on that bubble that are in the same boat as Illinois. In fact, Illinois' former coach Bruce Weber at Kansas State is kind of in that scenario. They've got a game against TCU this week, another bubble team. That's kind of considered almost an elimination game mm-hmm. for the tournament.
I mean, it's hard mm-hmm. to say right now because there's probably close to 100 teams who would be trying to get 68 spots at this point. So, you know, we'll have to see what happens. Certainly, Illinois has a chance, which no one gave them a couple weeks ago. I think, in particular, they have of all the Big Ten teams, I think they have the strongest strength of schedule, mm-hmm. Which is helping them a lot and would help them a lot. One scenario I've heard is that theoretically they win. Of course, we talk about this stuff, and then Illinois is going to get blown out by 20 points tonight because that's how it goes. But if they theoretically won their last two games and Northwestern lost their last two games, Northwestern's never made the NCAA tournament. They've seemingly been in great shape all year. They are struggling here at the end. They lost twice to Illinois. So if Illinois wins their last two, Northwestern loses their last two, there's a good chance, maybe even a 100% chance, they would meet in the Big Ten tournament in the first round. And basically that would more or less be a play-in game.
Can Illinois lose a game like one of these? You're saying they have to win basically at least three more games.
Probably.
So if they lost one, but all the other people who are supposed to lose also lost, could they still be asked to the tournament? They can't lose, basically? Is that what we're saying here?
I think they could maybe lose to Michigan State tonight, and then that would probably put pressure on them to win another game
maybe
the Big Ten tournament.
At least another one, maybe two.
They're here tonight, right?
Right.
Because losing – Michigan State has been playing very well lately, but – still, they're not such a great team that losing at home would be a good thing. Anyway, it's complicated. This fun time
always
of year.
Always complicated.
I know the Illinois women play at 12:30 in the Big Ten tournament. Not necessarily expected to go very far, but who knows?
Yes. So we'll see what happens with March Madness getting underway. But we've got a fun show here for you today. On the agenda, the intentional walk, which may be going by the wayside in Major League Baseball. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about players who transition into management, not just coaching, but actually managing a professional sports team. We'll talk about that a little bit. And why the stigma for the underhand free throw? That's also on the docket for today. Plus, I've got a rivalry for you. We'll talk about a little college basketball rivalry that I think John and I are both pretty familiar with. We'll have that coming up as the show goes on as well. Let's start with the intentional walk. There's been a proposal in Major League Baseball. They're getting rid of the four pitches needed for an intentional walk. All you have to do is signal from the dugout, I want to put this guy on first base. So no, you don't have to actually throw the pitches anymore. So I will start out by saying not a fan.
Well, we should probably talk about why they're doing it. For a long time now, the average baseball fan has been aging at the same rate as the average PBS donor, which I'll... And for both Major League Baseball and us in public media, we would like to change those things. Major League Baseball has been trying desperately to speed up what they call the pace of game. I think the issue isn't necessarily that the games are 3 hours. It's that there's a lot of time between pitches and a lot of stuff tends to happen. Major League Baseball has been trying to implement a few things. They've talked about a pitching clock. In fact, I think they implemented it, but didn't really.
In the minor leagues, it's going. Yeah.
So the idea behind getting rid of the intentional walk is to speed up the pace of play so that you don't have to sit there and watch a pitcher throw four pitches. I think maybe very small secondary issue is that number of pitches for pitchers has become a huge issue over the last 15 to 20 years. And, you know, I don't think there's much wear and tear on our arm from throwing intentional pitches, but, you know, that's also there.
So I've watched some baseball in my life.
Yeah.
That four pitches doesn't take that much time. And the intentional walk is used often, maybe once or twice a game, maybe. Yeah. So that to me is sort of a weird argument that it's going to quicken the pace of the game when it's not used in every game and it's only four pitches that can be thrown pretty quickly. I mean, it's like the catcher stands up, holds his glove out, pitcher tosses the ball. There's no getting ready or, you know, that whole routine that pitchers do. So it seems to me I understand the optics of it, like, hey, we're quickening the pace of the game, but really this change is only going to speed it up by approximately 2 minutes a game.
Yeah, it's complete window dressing in my opinion. If you want
but
to
why?
If
why
you
would
want
they say
to
that?
It's something they can point to and say we're doing something. That's basically the only reason to do it. If they want to actually quicken the pace of play, the pitch clock in between pitches would be a much better way to do that. You could reduce the number of visits to the mound, not only by coaches, but also by players. You know, I think I saw somebody, a baseball writer, make the point, these are adults. They can figure out a lot of these strategy things on their own. They don't need to have a big strategy session on the pitcher's mound that takes minutes to figure this stuff out.
No, it's not about that. A lot of the time it's about giving the pitcher a rest or something like that.
Yeah.
I have zero problem with... I'm a big baseball fan. I have zero problem with them making automatic intentional walks. I think we were talking off mic, Brian, and I think Lisa was there too, about how once in a blue moon, once every couple of years, someone throws a wild pitch or it comes too close and the hitter hits it.
You should actually be able to execute the intentional walk if you want to use the intentional walk.
Right. And so I actually have – I did a little quick research.
Hey.
And so batters can swing at intentional walk pitches if they want to. It's happened 12 times in the modern era of baseball.
Oh,
that
my.
Is
12 times. And how many – out of how many at-bats?
A lot.
Right. Many at-bats. The batter has reached base safely 9 of those times. And in all cases, the batter's team won.
Yeah.
The most recent time it happened was 2006.
All right.
So it's not – completely, I mean, you know, it adds, and we've talked about this in previous episodes, it keeps this sort of like wild card element to the game where something weird can happen. And baseball, lots of weird things can happen. Obviously, we've seen many weird things happen in baseball, but this is just one of those things. I was trying to think of an equivalent in another sport. Like if you got rid of something in another sport that would have the same sort of, it would be more of a window dressing-y thing, but they couldn't do it anymore. They were just sort of speeding it up. I couldn't really get my brain going around that this morning. But I do think I was also curious too. Just as long as we're talking about going back to the 1900s, like has this been a part of baseball since baseball was invented as a game? I tried to find some.
Yeah, who knows? I don't know.
Like Wikipedia yielded no results there, and I'm sure somebody out there probably knows. But
yeah, I'd have to look that up. I don't.
It's a shortcut. You know, it's like a keyboard shortcut to. So it's like useful maybe in the grand scheme, But it just seems weird. And I found a couple of articles, one pro, one con. So we'll make sure that we post those. But it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if you're waiting around for something that happens once every 11 or 12 years.
It's not that you're waiting around for it to happen. It's that there's always the chance it could happen.
That's one of the beauties of baseball.
Well,
in my
opinion. There are a lot of things that could happen. I don't know. I think there's better fights to be had about the purity of baseball than worrying about watching a guy stand there and
throw sure.
pitches.
There's also better arguments to be had about the pace of play in baseball than the intentional walk.
So I have a question about football, American football.
Yeah.
So you know how they have that clock going between plays, like they have a 30-second mm-hmm. clock or whatever? When did that get implemented? Because I know that
that's
hasn't
been, well, the
always
time,
been
the
there.
Time has been changed here and there, but the clock has been there ever since I've watched football.
Really?
And I mean, those serve different purposes. They're not just there to speed up the pace of play. They're to prevent a team from just basically taking the ball and sitting on it for
right.
to kill the clock.
Yeah, you know, in a sport with a excuse me, in a sport with an actual clock like football or basketball, mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. have those clocks in place just to
sure.
ensure that somebody
maybe they should
sit
like
on
a
lead.
Shot clock.
Maybe they should
or
institute
whatever.
A clock
yeah.
in baseball, like 3 outs or 4 minutes.
No, John. No.
I think the guy from the Chicago Tribune, the article that I read, was just like, you know, baseball gains nothing by doing this, but they lose a part of their history. So, which as
strongly
a
disagree.
As a history person, I'm sort of, you know, I kind of like aspects of the game like that, little quirky aspects.
Yeah, take that, John. Yeah. We like quirky.
I love quirky. It's just the intentional walk is not quirky. It's just bull.
You're blah.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. It's on. All right. Well, that's a fun topic, especially as spring training is underway
yeah.
and the baseball season is coming at us like a freight train. I'm sure you guys will talk about it a lot. Is everybody playing now? Like when I was in Florida,
yeah.
Pitchers and catchers were reporting at that time. And I was in Bradenton, which is the home of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Oh, well.
We didn't go to a game or anything. Didn't see anybody, I don't think. But it's around. Like right. Bradenton very much loves their team.
Well, and during spring training, you know, probably like hanging out with every other third person is probably plays for the Pirates because they bring so many people in.
Right? Yeah, minor league players, everybody gets invited down to spring training. So that's the look at the intentional walk where John is wrong and Lisa and I are right.
That's right.
Elsewhere today, ownership and team management. It's very common for players to go into coaching once they retire, but you also see players occasionally go into upper levels of management for a team. And this is kind of prompted by the announcement that Magic Johnson is taking over as team president for the Los Angeles Lakers after a couple of executives, including Jim Buss, fired by the LA Lakers after another dismal season. We'll see if Magic can use his magic to revive the Lakers.
I think it's being widely panned because Magic Johnson is kind of famous for doing GM-like moves on his Twitter account that people think are outrageous and crazy. but I don't know. He's obviously the number one athlete. Well, maybe not now with Kobe Bryant, but probably
yeah,
historically,
still, yeah.
Magic Johnson is. So, I mean, it's in some ways it's a good PR move, but it'll be interesting to see how that works out. I note that the 49ers also have riled up the sports media by choosing former safety John Lynch to be their general manager. We talked about a little bit about this, but basically there's a long history of ex-players not only becoming GMs but just executives in general. I think probably over the last 15 to 20 years it is being frowned upon more than historically. You know, historically there'd be a lot of players who would, especially, you know, you think, look back at baseball or something, players would play, they would coach, and then they would become the GM. George Halas famously was the coach and then owner of the Bears, right? But I guess he never played. That's a terrible example.
Terrible.
Just a few big names in recent time. You had, and we can talk about the good and the bad, but you have Larry Bird, Hank Aaron, George Brett, John Paxson, Michael Jordan, Isaiah Thomas. Phil Jackson was a player and then
mm-hmm.
a coach.
Yeah.
Danny Ainge, Ken Williams, So those are just a few names out there. A lot of them actually have done very well, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. You sort of have this the general consensus in sports is the nerds make the good GMs and the jocks don't, right? And I think that's not true, but it seems to be like the
that's right. kind of the standard,
yeah.
conventional
well, not
wisdom
all,
now.
Not all yeah. jocks have the nerdiness maybe needed to run a team. You know, as we talked about in our planning meeting, teams are being run much more like businesses. And we're talking here in the big male-dominated
right.
professional sports. So they're being run like businesses. So the nerds come in with business background who maybe have an affinity for a sport or they're just a really good strategist around the sport, but they also have this business background like Theo from the Cubs, you know, and they're able to be very successful. So it stands to reason to me that the nerds will probably be pretty successful, but not all players who become GMs or directors of operations necessarily have the nerdiness to get the job done the same way.
Yeah, and I think in a lot of cases, sometimes when it works the best is kind of when you have a combination in the front office. I think of the Denver Broncos, for instance, with John Elway as their team president. He's there. He's been instrumental in signing a lot of players to come to Denver. They still, you know, players still know John Elway. They respect what he did as a player. So I think when you're talking with a free agent coming in, to have somebody like a John Elway to be in on those negotiations and things like that certainly I think can help close the deal. At the same time, then you've got some other really good talent evaluators to work on the draft and some other aspects of building the team. So that, you know, a guy like Elway is not making all of those decisions in a micromanaging
right.
basis.
Do you think some of these players who decide that they want to go into this after, you know, it's their post-career, do you think some of them have an overinflated sense of what it is that they'll be able to do?
I don't think so. I think the classic example is Michael Jordan probably, right?
Okay.
I would say so, yeah. Because and Michael's example goes back to when he was with Washington. That was where he first kind of went into team management, and they were pretty famously really bad under his tenure in Washington. The big bust of a draft pick there was Kwame Brown, and Jordan was instrumental in making that pick there in Washington, and he flamed out. And Washington was never any good when Jordan was in management there. Things have been a little bit better in Charlotte. They've at least been decent, but they still have not been what you would call a contender in the Eastern Conference.
So where does that come from, though? Do you think they think, like, hey, I've been a successful player, so I'm going to go right into this, you know, into management? I mean, I have to think that not everybody is going to have a taste necessarily for the more administrative boring, not boring, but do you know what I mean? Like, do they go into it thinking, I'm still going to be a star, I'm going to bring in all this talent, I'm going to make these decisions just like I did on the court? I mean,
why
do people let them do that? Why are they hired to do that?
Well, I think in Jordan's case,
He didn't
buy the team in Charlotte?
Yeah.
And in Washington, I don't remember what the case was. I think it might have been part of the deal.
Yeah.
He had some ownership there, but that might have been part of the deal when he was a player there as well, that he would transition into management once he retired. And if you're an NBA franchise, certainly you get yourself a lot of attention, at least initially, when Michael Jordan is a part of your franchise in whatever capacity. After that, though, I think it's like anything else. If you don't win, you know, the fans aren't going to come to games and nobody's really going to be that interested if you're not ultimately successful.
And they're like Larry Bird was very successful in Indiana first as a coach and then as an executive. Pat Riley actually was a player and then a coach and then, you know, got Dwayne Wade and some other guy to come to Miami and win a few championships. So there's definitely been very successful examples. I think the worm has turned, so to speak, based on a couple of really huge flameouts, even worse than Michael Jordan, and that would be Isaiah Thomas with the Knicks,
yeah.
which was a disaster for several reasons, maybe primarily because weren't there sexual harassment charges?
Yeah, I think there were.
the most famous example, though, in terms of just flaming out is Matt Millen. Matt Millen was a player for several years, then an announcer.
And yeah, then an analyst, took, yeah.
Took over as the GM of the Detroit Lions, who he then led to the worst 8-year record in modern NFL history. There were often chants of F Matt Millen throughout the Silverdome, and his career, his GM career culminated in he was let go, obviously, midway through the season, but an 0-16 season in 2008. So I think he really, like, you know, when I saw the news that John Lynch had been hired for the 49ers, my first reaction was Matt Millen all over again. I think that's the reaction people think. And Matt Millen is famously, as an analyst, kind of a know-it-all. You could kind of hear in his the way he analyzed things that, like, he thinks he knew better than everyone. So I think Joe and Janet, sports fan out there, probably really like to have the opportunity to say, you didn't know what you were talking about.
Yeah, so I think that's a pretty good summary there.
My other question is, where are the women?
That's a good question. Yeah, you know, and I think part of it is that as I think about this, a lot of times you have these businessmen who buy teams, and they're kind of attracted, I think, to that whole guys club kind of thing where I'm going to buy this team and it's going to be great. And
so, to be 100% accurate, are you saying where are the women in general in executives, or where are the former female players?
Well, right. I mean, as I think the discussion that we had was like a lot of players go into management. But we've also talked about the nerds. And there are plenty of women in the corporate world and in the business world and in the tech world and in all of these other worlds where their business acumen and their strategic thinking is finely honed, but they're not in sports. Now, that could be because they don't want to be there. We did find one. We found Kim Eng. I believe she works under Joe Torre as the deputy VP of
operations
for Major League Baseball. So that's a very high level job. But you know, and I'm sure if I did some more digging, I could probably find more women. But by and large, you're hearing a lot more about the guys in these positions. That's a fair question, though, because like how many women are going into management, like staying away from coaching and going into the more operations side of things in the women's NBA or in some of these other sports or owning teams and calling the shots. Hopefully that's something that will happen more as women's sports, even in soccer and other things, you know, start to come up. But it is, to me, if we're talking about people in business, that should not be excluding women from the conversation.
Right.
Players totally understand.
Yeah.
If you're coming up as a player in baseball or the NBA or whatever and have ties to a team or teams, I totally get that. But like there's other Theos out there who are female, I think, who would be great.
I think it's it's like Brian said, a lot of these are old boys clubs. In a lot of cases you have the former players coming up or former people being associated with it. And there's, you know, there's still all this built-in fear of whatever. Certainly it's probably to, like you said, there are plenty of probably female Theos are out there who, you know, there are a lot of teams who are probably losing out a lot. And I think, you know, it'll probably take one female Theo to sort of throw it all out, and hopefully someone will take a chance on that soon.
Well, yeah, I agree. And I think it's also about being a fan, you know, and having an affinity for a sport and really like caring about it and wanting to work in it and feeling passionate about it. That's how, I mean, there's plenty of guys who would out in the world who would love to work for a team who don't get to do that, you know, so there's. But I think it does go back to like being a fan and not just playing the sport, but loving the sport and then having the climate be inclusive enough so that women can see themselves in those positions. So, it's interesting. I would like to see more women, but hopefully that will happen.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a look at management ownership in professional sports. Next up, a little lighter topic.
Sort of.
Yeah, I would call it a little lighter. But the stigma against shooting free throws underhand. The last really prominent player to do it regularly was Rick Barry, who played back in the 60s and 70s. Really, since that time, nobody of note, you know, no stars in the NBA, even in stars in college basketball, have shot their free throws underhanded, even though in a lot of cases it could very well increase their free throw shooting percentage.
In most cases, I think, like in when it's been tested out, the percentage is always higher. So, yeah, I was kind of wondering about this, and I've been wondering about it for a long time anyway. Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote The Tipping Point and several other books and is a writer for The New Yorker, has a podcast called Revisionist History, which is not in production at this moment. I think it's on hiatus. But the first season was last year, and one of his episodes was based around this story of Wilt Chamberlain, very famous basketball player, terrible free throw shooter, who saw his free throw percentage rise when he was when he tried shooting granny style, okay, underhanded free throw shooting, and it was just like, whoa, this is amazing. And then he stopped, and he stopped because he said he thought he looked like, and I quote, a sissy. So in this podcast and in the analysis, it was determined that players like Wilt or Shaquille O'Neal, who said, I believe I'm too cool to do that, something like that, or it doesn't look cool, so I'm not going to do it. They are what is called a high threshold personality, where crowds basically dictate their behavior. So they care what people think. Now, somebody like Rick Barry, who saw an opportunity to be incredibly consistent in his free throw shooting, did not care what he looked like to get there. He just wanted the high percentage to be able to sink the free throw at a critical moment or to be able to make that difference. So he's a low threshold personality, where he is, those people are less likely to care what other people think as long as they achieve the desired result. So my question, which I posed to the group off, I almost said off camera, off microphone, was, you know, here are some guys and women, because no women shoot underhand free throws either that I've seen. They say they'll do anything to win. They do whatever it takes. They lift the weights. They eat the food or don't eat the food. And they find the coaches. They do the meditation. They do everything, but they won't do that. And I said it was like that Meatloaf song, that he'll do anything for love, but he won't do that, whatever it was. In this case, it's shooting underhand. So discuss.
Yeah, when we talked about this last week, I was just thinking back on it, and I certainly remember the, kind of on the playground at elementary school, you know, as I got to be kindergarten, first, second grade, you know, when I was first shooting baskets on the playground on a 10-foot hoop, I was shooting underhanded because that's the only way I had the strength to get the ball up to the basket. As I got older and gained strength, I was able to start – you know, pushing the ball at first with two hands overhanded, and then as you know, you develop your form, you're able to do that with one hand. And I think for me at least, and there was always a stigma for when it was myself and there were other kids who still didn't have the strength to push the ball overhanded to the basket, there was always a stigma behind that you weren't strong enough to shoot that way. So you got made fun of. So I was always trying to, you know, work on that and get to the point where I could shoot overhanded so the other kids wouldn't make fun of me anymore. And I think that type of stigma has stayed with the underhanded shot in large part because it's perceived as a weakness.
I will say when you first brought this up, we talked about the stigma and you said Wilt Chamberlain said it looked feminine. And I thought back and I thought, oh, that, and it's called the granny shot. It's not called the grampy shot.
That's true.
I admit, like, my first response is, oh, that seems weird, because my thought is, yeah, it's just weird. It's not – I'm not – but then I looked on the internet, and all over the place, it's like, oh, it's too feminine. I don't want to do that. Oh, it's too girly. So, yeah, there is this huge stigma that it's, like, girly, which is kind of ridiculous because, like you said, if you look at the, you know, WNBA or women's college basketball, it's not like any of them are whipping it up there with – underhand. And
right.
I can, and we talked about this, but you know, There's Rick Barry's son is now
Canyon Barry. Who does he play for? Is it St. Mary's?
Charleston. College of Charleston.
College of Charleston.
Never mind.
And he made like 60 free throws.
Something like that.
A huge amount. Yeah. So he's doing it, and I think that's good because, as I said, I think if you are a woman in the WNBA or women's college basketball, the last thing. Probably, unless you are one of these, what was the word for it?
Low threshold personalities,
mm-hmm. and you can do it. Otherwise, it's just going to be like you're reinforcing the stereotype, which is obviously ridiculous. But mm-hmm. I can understand why you wouldn't want to be the person to do it.
But again, all these athletes want to do, or what they say they want to do, is to win. It's always about winning. I will do whatever it takes to win. I'm a winner. I like to win rings. I like to win trophies. I like to win championships. I like to get the things that come with winning, endorsements and whatever. But they won't do this one thing. And I'm not calling out men here, although men are the ones who say it looks girly because they're othering it in some way, because women won't do it either. But again, so to me, it's like there is statistical proof that people improve. Shaquille O'Neal is a terrible free throw shooter. He probably lost many games by being the guy who got fouled and went to the line. Yeah. So but that's okay because he at least looked cool shooting. He didn't look that great shooting his regular free throw either.
No.
Okay. So like, as I recall, his form was he kind of just heaved it up there like he didn't care. So it's like, I don't understand. I guess I'm trying to understand, and this is not something that I ever thought about before I heard this podcast, by the way. But it's perfectly legal as a shot. Why aren't more people doing it? And so if you say you want to win, you really care more about what you as a person look like than possibly, you know, doing whatever will statistically improve your chances of helping your team win a game.
I mean, I think saying that you want to do everything to win and doing everything are sort of two different things. I mean, there is this culture in sports. Ever since SportsCenter became a thing, everybody just wants to look good and dunk. You know what I mean? There really is this culture in sports that, you know, I want to win, but I want to look cool doing it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's no doubt that cool points count. But that's you have a whole bunch of high threshold personalities in professional sports, and not many low threshold personalities who are interested in doing whatever it takes to win, like literally whatever. So they'll do anything to win, including that. To paraphrase Meatloaf.
All right. Roll the Meatloaf song.
We'll never solve this problem, by the way, so if anybody wants to weigh in on this, I'd be curious to hear your opinions.
Absolutely.
And I would do anything for love. I'd run right into hell and back. I would do anything for love. I'll never lie to you, and that's a fact. But I'll never forget the way you feel right now. Oh, no, no way. And I would do anything for love, but I won't do that.
More of the bandwagon coming up in just a minute. But first, all this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they'll love. So right now, think of a friend, your mom, anyone you care about. What podcast do you think they would really like? Got it? Now do it. Tell them about it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know about podcasts, well, show them how. Tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod, that's T-R-Y pod, and thanks for spreading the word. With that, it is rivalry time. And it is my turn, and neither of you know the rivalry I'm going to bring up. That's because until about 40 minutes ago. I didn't know the rivalry I was going to bring up. But I think I've got a pretty good one, especially for folks in this part of the world. John Steinbacher, when I say the name Bruce Pearl, what comes to mind?
Man covered in Tennessee orange from head to toe with his shirt off. No, his comes to mind is someone who recorded the highest scoring basketball player in the history of University of Illinois, allegedly telling him that he was being offered a blazer and $80,000 by Jimmy Collins.
Yes, exactly right. So the rivalry is a little more broad than that, but this is really what sparked the rivalry between Illinois and Iowa in college basketball in the late 80s and early 90s. And John pretty well summarized the kind of what sparked it. Deion Thomas was one of the highest rated recruits coming out of high school, Chicago Simeon. Just very well-regarded basketball player coming out of high school, and both Illinois and Iowa were really recruiting him hard. So Bruce Pearl was an assistant coach at Iowa at the time. Jimmy Collins was an assistant coach at Illinois. Bruce Pearl accused Jimmy Collins of offering Deion Thomas $80,000 and a Chevy Blazer to come to Illinois. He recorded a phone call in which basically Pearl put the words in Deion Thomas's mouth, and Deion said, "Yeah." It's basically what the phone call was, as I remember the audio. But I wanted to look at this from both sides of it, because I grew up in Iowa, big Iowa fan growing up. So as you might expect, when I was getting this story from the Iowa perspective, well, it was, you know, those dirty cheaters at Illinois offering this guy a blazer and $80,000. You know, what's wrong with those guys? They should be caught, and they should, you know, get the death penalty and all this other stuff. You know, that's what I was hearing from that side of the story. John Steinbacher, what were you hearing?
Well, obviously that was not too long after what to that point was the most successful basketball team in Illinois history, the 1989 Flying Illini. Lou Henson, who, by all counts, a wonderful human being, was held to super high acclaim throughout Illinois, especially in Champaign-Urbana. So even though it wasn't Lou Henson, obviously it was Jimmy Collins, I think the blowback from this was severe, because in everyone's mind around here, as you said, Bruce Pearl put the words in Deion Thomas's mind and had some sort of vendetta. I think time has come to show that Bruce Pearl is not the most up and up scoundrel. I probably shouldn't say that. I'm editorializing. Scoundrel in the history of college basketball. He's everywhere he goes.
I think slimy is the word.
Slime follows. But yeah, the perspective here was, it was a setup, and they're trying to bring down the good name of Lou Henson and tear down what had been building up to be a perennial college basketball powerhouse. And, you know, I think they kind of did. I mean, the Illinois basketball, that was sort of the beginning of the end of Lou Henson's era here. I mean, you could point to a lot of different reasons, but, I mean,
That was big.
What year was this again?
This all happened in 1990. It was the spring of 1990 when all this went down.
Which is just a year after.
Yeah, it kind of happened. It all came out like right after the Flying Illini season. And the NCAA announced the punishment for all of this after the 1990 season. And I think Illinois maybe got a two-year ban from the NCAA tournament as a result of that, which, of course, hurt Illinois in recruiting. I think they might have been penalized a couple scholarships in that process as well, which again hurt their recruiting. So from Illinois' perspective, they're, you know, as John said, they're kind of at the all-time high as a program. They've just come off that Final Four season. But
they're
then
recruiting
they really
Deion Thomas, one of the best players in the country.
Yeah, so they can't build on it.
They've got that Chicago pipeline rolling. You know, Jimmy Collins didn't famously held a grudge against Bruce Pearl for a long time. Didn't they play each other when he the coach at?
Yeah. Bruce Pearl got the job at Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I mean, Pearl ended up leaving Iowa not too long after all this happened, and he kind of was blacklisted a little bit in the coaching world for when all this went down. He went and coached at a Division II school. I think Southern Indiana was where he coached for a while. Then he did get the job at Wisconsin-Milwaukee, which happened to be in the same conference as UIC, where Jimmy Collins was coaching. Mm. Bruce Pearl, you know, he was always one who liked the spotlight. He tried to shake Jimmy Collins' hand before a game, I think, in 2004, and Jimmy was having none of it, you know, because Jimmy was still upset about it, and I don't think you can blame him. I mean, it was, you know, 14, 15 years later, but, you know, Jimmy thought at the time that all this went down, I think he thought he would be the one to succeed Lou Henson at Illinois, but after all the stuff from the NCAA came down and all that, that didn't happen.
And we should actually talk about the rivalry. Like, I mean, Iowa and Illinois are traditionally, you know, rivals. But mm-hmm. I mean, in the 90s, that was
it was on fire. I remember, you know, leading into this. I mean, Illinois and Iowa both were really good in the mid to late 80s. Mm-hmm. When Illinois had their Final Four team, Iowa had a good team at that time. I think 2 years earlier, Iowa had a team that went to the Elite Eight. It was Tom Davis's first year at Iowa, and one of the highlights of that season was they came here to Champaign-Urbana to play Illinois, and they were down by 20 points in the second half, and Iowa came back and won that game in overtime at Illinois. I remember listening to my clock radio in my bedroom to the end of that game.
What's a clock radio?
Yeah, I know. Going way back. So the rivalry was already going, and then you had the whole Deion Thomas saga that really sparked it. Then a couple years later, there was a game here in Champaign-Urbana that was pretty memorable. Do you know which one I'm talking about, John Steinbacher?
I don't.
I believe it was 1993. And Mr. Andy Kaufman caught a three-quarter court pass, I think from T.J. Wheeler, to beat Iowa at the buzzer here in Champaign-Urbana. So, and I think that was a pretty sweet win for the folks here in Champaign-Urbana.
Indeed. Now that you say that, of course, I remember the game. But the mid-90s, you know, I was, yeah, grunge. I wasn't into sports.
Same.
Yeah. So anyway, those are a couple of highlights of the Illinois-Iowa rivalry. It's kind of cooled off a little bit, just in part because neither Illinois nor Iowa has been great the last 10 years. You know, Iowa's had a couple decent teams over that time. Illinois's had a couple decent teams over that time. But neither one's been great. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you've really seen that rivalry heat up like it was.
No, it would be good if both teams were pretty good at the same time. But who knows when that's going to happen.
Hard telling. So anyway, that's our rivalry for this week.
Thanks,
Illinois,
Brian.
And Iowa. You are welcome.
We should point out that Bruce Pearl went on to have a fairly successful career, although he coached
with
Tennessee.
Slime.
Coached at Tennessee, which was my reference to him being painted. Just want to point that out so people don't think I'm crazy.
No, he was not painted in Illini orange. It was that bright, weird Tennessee orange.
And now he's the coach at Alabama?
Auburn.
Auburn's in Alabama.
I noticed they have a really good recruiting class next year.
Oh, how'd that happen?
Yeah, I wonder.
So there's your rivalry for this week. Time to close things out with our status update. Who wants to start things off this week?
Somebody else should start because I accidentally closed my computer.
Oh, no.
So we mentioned it's spring training, and of course we're going to talk about baseball, but I did want to mention, my paper's over here. I've never watched Dancing with the Stars. I can't believe it's still on the freaking TV. I understand the appeal of, like, B-list celebrities, even C-list celebrities dancing poorly. In fact, our Secretary of Energy or of Interior, which one?
The Texas dancing guy?
Yeah, he was on Dancing with the Stars, apparently. Mm. Anyway, today it was announced that former Chicago Cub backup catcher / cult hero David Ross is going to be on the next season of Dancing with the Stars. So I thought that was interesting. I noticed that in addition to David Ross, we've got Nancy Kerrigan, Simone Biles, which, come on. Of course she's going to win. She's a gymnast. David Ross doesn't stand a chance. And former NFLer Rashad Jennings. Anyway, so this is just interesting. Like, athletes still go on Dancing with the Stars. I don't know. Good for David Ross, but come on, man. He also is in, like, all these weird cereal commercials that I'm seeing in Chicago.
Yeah. He's he's cashing in.
Yeah, I know. Good for him. But and I appreciate all that, but I'm moving on.
All right. Very good. You want me to go next, Lisa?
I can go if that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah, it's right here. So I read on the internet, as I was browsing Reddit, that Warren Buffett, businessman extraordinaire, has offered $1 million a year for life to an employee of his who guesses the Sweet 16.
Mm.
So now it's funny because as somebody in the comment section of where I was pointed out, he's cheaping out because in 2014 he offered $1 billion to the person who guessed the whole thing, I guess. So now it's just a paltry $1 million for life if you guess the Sweet 16.
Well, I will say this.
Correct.
That's probably easier.
Oh, yeah.
It's easier to guess the Sweet 16 than it is to get the entire bracket right.
Much
yes,
easier.
Yes. Yeah. And he says that even if nobody wins the grand prize of $1 million for life, he will award a $100,000 prize to whoever gets the furthest in guessing the winners in the men's college basketball tournament. So he's got like over a quarter of a million employees, and about 80,000 of them, I think, submit brackets.
Did they give the statistics?
I was just wondering. Not in this article, but I bet there are.
I mean, obviously.
What are the odds?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see odds. And you can't say the odds are just whatever because certain teams are more likely to win, but it's interesting. Yeah, I think there's a. I wish I worked for him.
Yeah, I'd enter. Why not?
Oh, so would I. Multiple times. Maybe you can only get
Brian
one
Moline.
Time. Anyway.
Maybe you should make that offer to employees of Illinois Public Media.
Maybe someone with $1 million should.
A year for life.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's not forget. All right.
All right. Very good. Mine. If you're familiar with Georgetown basketball at all, you know the name John Thompson. Big John was the head coach there for 25, 30 years. Then they had about a five-year run by someone else named Craig Escherich, who was very much not memorable during his time at Georgetown. But then Big John's son, John Thompson III, took over, and everybody was like, oh, yeah, it's going to be great. You know, get the Thompson name back at Georgetown.
Nepotism again.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was good for a while. Sweet 16 appearance, Final Four appearance in the first few years. But since that time, in the last 10 years, Georgetown has a grand total of 3 wins in the NCAA tournament against powerhouses like Maryland, Baltimore County, Belmont, and Eastern Washington. So not so good. And now, apparently, there's a lot of scuttlebutt that JT3 might be on his way out, except Big John is still hanging around the program. And nobody is brave enough to actually say anything to Big John about it.
Interesting. How is he hanging around the program? What does he do?
Yeah, I think he works in the athletic department. I don't see his official position listed, but he's still around the program.
He just looms in the background behind people. Like, people in the athletic department are, like, doing things in their office, and he's just standing there with his arms.
Here's how ESPN's Jeff Goodman describes it. The school recently named the brand-new $65 million John R. Thompson Jr. Intercollegiate Athletic Center after him. He's close in power with those in power at the university, including school president John J. DeGioia. And he declined to speak for this story. Any former players who were actually talked to would not give their names for this story. That's how much they're still afraid of Big John at Georgetown.
Jeez.
So we'll see what happens there. And And Georgetown is having a bad season. They're 14-16 overall. They're not going to make the tournament unless they can somehow make a magical run in their conference tournament. So that's that. And that's a wrap on the bandwagon for this week. But as always, we have credits.
Yes, we do. We first and foremost want to thank you for joining us on the bandwagon. This episode was produced by Brian Moline, Lisa Braltz, and John Steinbacher. There are other people who have helped make bandwagon a thing despite huge odds. Speaking of the odds, Scott Cameron, Jim Kelly, Mike Bowman, Taylor Judd, and from Athens, GA, the band REM. They perform our theme music, in case you hadn't figured that out. You can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon, where we link to almost everything we discuss on the pod. Videos, audio, social media accounts, much more. Better yet, you can subscribe to Bandwagon and rate it in iTunes. Rating us really helps people discover us. And who doesn't want to be discovered? Am I right? No iTunes, no biggie. Just find us wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Bandwagon Podcast. No vowels in that Twitter handle there, to get our most recent thoughts on everything. And we all have our own Twitter accounts, too. And you can follow us from there, as is your want. We love questions, links, recommendations. Please bring them to us. We will be back in a couple of weeks for yet another episode about the sometimes strange intersections between sports and everything else. Until then, thanks for playing.